Session number 106.25, Rule 2.
Mr. McRae, Rule 2. So how frightening was it playing this cat and mouse game with the Japanese in the jungle?
It went on in the daytime, then there was night patrols as well, and we were fit. You just stood it. It was all part of the game. I mean, you got used to going without sleep and all that. You just slept where you could, when you could. You were covering a large area of ground, and you had to get your rest as you could.
How long would the patrol go out for then, typically?
You might be out for 2 or 3 hours. Or you could be out all night. Later on, very often I was out right almost to the break of daylight, and then you came back in.
What was it like actually being in the jungle?
Could be very eerie and could be very frightening if you didn't keep a sharp hold on it. Mostly it was knowing where you were, knowing the route you was going out, what you was looking for, what you was going to do. You had a pre-arranged signs and things, and you came back. You had to come. You couldn't go out from one area of your perimeter and come back in another one, because at night time everyone stayed in their holes, and you just couldn't walk around aimlessly if you could get shot. In fact, we lost a sergeant major like that. He walked around at night, looking, seeing if everything was all right, and he got shot in the process. And it was then, once darkness fell, if it was a patrol going out, you went out from a certain spot, and the sentry was on that spot all the time while you was out, and you came back in that certain spot and to a prearranged signal.
What was the prearranged
signal? Well, it could be a whistle, mostly a whistle, a set whistle.
Did you each have a compass?
Oh, yes, you carried a compass. You knew you had to have a compass to what direction you was going. Very often you could read at night, and you could take a back bearing and come back on that course.
Was that every man or just?
No, mostly NCOs. So if you was a sergeant, you had one. It was your own, more or less personal property. Your watch, compass, whistle, and all that sort of thing. All the senior NCOs carried those, and to a large degree, a lot of the junior NCOs, when I say junior, that's corporal or lance corporal, they had them if there was enough to issue.
Did you think that every man should have had a compass?
Well, not every man was able to read them. Some chaps just couldn't get on with them. I mean, they knew roughly. I mean, they was all taught at some time or other in their training and all the way through their training, but if you said to a chap, give me a back bearing on a measurement, they had no idea how to do it or how to think it.
How easy was it to get lost in the jungle?
Very easy. Very, very easy to get lost on this tall elephant grass. That's mostly where you lost your bearings. Daytime it was easier because the sun, you always had an idea where the sun was coming up from. So you knew what direction you was in. But night time, I personally learnt the stars or the moon. In those few years I was out in India and Burma, I learnt more about the stars and the moon than I ever did in my life. I knew what direction the bottom of Orion came down, for example, and I knew if I looked at that, I could go southeast. And what time the moon came up and what time it went down. All these things assisted you at night time.
What was the jungle round about Kohima like?
Kohima itself was a town, a Naga village, with an English administrator and magistrate and all that, you see, tea plantations around it. But on the outer edges, there was some pretty thick, quite thick jungle. Wild country, and only the natives or the Nagas knew the tracks in there. You could get completely and hopelessly lost in there because it was so hilly and mountainous on the outside.
But was it trees, bushes, or grass?
Trees and yes. Also, there was all sorts of stuff, a lot of vines and all.
What about insect pests and animal pests
In the rainy season, you got ticks. Now, ticks got everywhere. They was a little... you didn't see them when they were small. The only indication you knew them, they used to get down between your fingers and toes and anywhere there was a crease in the skin and bury their head in and suck the blood. And it wasn't until you looked at them and you saw a little brown blob there, you knew you had a tick on you. Leeches got in your through your laces and they would suck the blood and only drop off when they were bloated. The only way you could get them out was a lighted cigarette on the back of them. And they would draw the heads. If you pulled them off, you would lift a head inside your under your skin, and consequently, that would turn septic. Mosquitoes was always a danger at night.
Were you taking anti-malaria?
We were taking anti-malaria tablets, Mepricrin, that turned your skin and your your whites of your eyes yellow. Salt tablets. And later on, energy things, because of our lack of diet. Our diet was so bad. Our food was poor. The quality of food was poor and the quantity was low.
What did the food consist of then?
Well, it was a very, very... The meat was very, very poor quality. Eggs were very, very small. Any poultry was awfully very small. I mean, complete chicken. like that. Diet was rather low.
So what was the staple, rice or...?
We did have rice. Later on, I mean, as we moved deeper into Burma, we used to buy rice off the villagers. They'd cook it for us. And off the monks, we used to buy big molasses or sugar lumps. That was further on when we got, you know, as we progressed deeper into Burma, journey advanced through to Burma.
Did you live off biscuits as well?
Yes, we had biscuits. What we called, we weren't exactly the iron rations, but there was always biscuits and tins of cheese and the normal, perhaps the best meals of breakfast. We've got bacon, streaky bacon. Because it was all mostly tins, you say, tin stuff that the cooks had to deal with.
Did you show signs of malnourishment?
Well, no. Despite all that, we didn't show signs of malnourishment. It came out in perhaps a different way. There was always a lot of ulcers, jungle ulcers, boils and all this sort of thing. I think the lack of vitamins really showed itself on everybody in that respect. I think nearly everybody had what we call jungle ulcers or jungle sores. It was mainly through that if you scratch yourself, you festered. And it was always boils going around you. On one occasion, I had 54 boils. As one finished, another one started. And I think I cut myself on a bit of corrugated roof on my wrist. And it took me about a month to heal because every day or so I had to go to the RAP and the doctor or the RAP sergeant would open it up and put cream on it to stop it from festering. It was that in that aspect where the undernourishment showed itself, not so much physically.
Did all this pull morale down?
No, it was... It was always the normal moaning, roll on my civvy street, you know, sort of business. But it didn't really pull them down. It was, they knew that we was in a bad theatre, we had to stick together, and it was, the fight was going to go on to the bitter end. And that was... nothing would really get them down.
Why do you think morale was so relatively good then?
I don't know. They was all good mates, and they knew that even... your own regiment or another regiment would. I mean, the Royal Scots, when we was at Coima, we got a little bit cut off. We were short of water and we wireless back, could anyone break through and bring some water? The Royal Scots done it. The Royal Scots sent a couple of platoons with water carriers and they broke through to us. When I say it was cut off, it was mostly sniper fire that was keeping everyone from moving. And we had a lot of our own wounded that we wanted to get out. So, I mean, you could always rely upon another regiment or even right up to divisional strength, brigade and divisional strength. I mean, long as you was a cross keys man, you could more or less go to any unit and you knew you could get help if you was desperate.
Cross keys was the...
was the divisional son. That was a...
two division.
What is it? That was a two division, yeah.
I was asking you about insect pests. Were there any bigger animals that were... a menace or a nuisance?
No. You would have thought that snakes would have been a menace, but they weren't. We used to see them. But you could never get near them. I can't think of anything else that... he was always wary of the snakes. Crates, particularly. It was a little... brown one about a foot long. They was what we regard as the most poisonous, you know. There was not a case that they attacked you, they come near you, they were more or less frightened. The more bolder variety of chap went out snake hunting with a long stick with a bit of string on the end of it to get them out and all this sort of lark. But they were the insects was the more the thing that bothered us more than anything. And up in, say, in the jungle itself, it was the tick and the leech that was the most bothersome. And then at night time was the mosquito.
Did you see much of the Nagas around Kohima?
Yes, they were very good, yeah. They, in fact, very, very hardy race. They're short, rather squat, like the Gurkha troops. They're short, they're very squat and very, very hardy. Even the women could carry a man up a hill. Which they did do when they evacuated a lot of our wounded. They were very, very helpful, the Nagas. In fact, I really don't know what we'd have done without them because they acted as porters, bringing out a lot of our stuff up as well. And they were guides through the jungle. Of course, the attack on Kohima Ridge had to be carried out by the Norfolk Regiment, supported by the Scots, but we had to find our way through the jungle with the Nagas. They showed us the tracks and the resting points where we could rest up while because we was about 4 or 5 days in doing a big encircling movement, which we called the trek. We called it the trek because you just trekked day after day, not really knowing where you was going.
Why do you think the Nagas were so helpful to you?
Well, as I say, Kohima itself was a village, a Naga, proper Naga organised village in peacetime with an English and minister, the English magistrate and all that, you see. And they looked towards the English. When the Jap got up there, the Jap was a little bit, well, not a little bit, a lot nasty to them. Burned their villages and treated them terribly as they did the Burmese people themselves. But the Nagas are the hill people. They're the hill tribesmen. And they're very good.
What do they look like? Apart from being short and stocky, you said.
They nearly all wore hide, bands of hide round their legs. This was a sort of religious, slightly religious thing that
like
gave
straps.
Them straps. Yeah, some say it was made of elephant hair. I don't know. It probably could have been or that. But they was always very friendly towards the British troops. Looked upon them as a saviour, I think.
Now, coming onto the campaign itself, you said when you first got to Kohima, you conducted patrol activity.
Mm-hmm.
How did your work develop from there, militarily?
Well, the Royal West Kents were relieved. We got that one brigade got right into the centre of Burma, but GTP overlooked Kohima.
This was a ridge, was it?
The ridge, GPT Ridge, or Kohima Ridge, as we called it. But the real name was GPT Ridge. It overlooked, and the Japanese were dug well into there and were able to fire down at the village. Well, we wanted a clearance from that ridge for many ways, because it controlled the road, which was a properly made-up macadam road, you know. It controlled the road and all the surrounding country. So the aim was to seize the ridge, to give us control of it. Well, we couldn't do a direct frontal assault because it was uphill the whole time. And we'd been a considerable disadvantage, as all the slopes, Japs were dug in all the slopes around there. So it meant a big encircling movement right the way around to the right, which our battalion was the leading lights of it. And the Scots came and were following up behind. The original intention was to probe out to see where we could go, but in the first probe, I was the leading. The night beforehand, I was the last patrol down the slope, or the other slopes behind, to find out how deep the Jap were encircling around it. And I sort of went down, and in the fading light, it was between the lights, I saw that they were digging in. And I knew the next day we were going down there. I took the first patrol out at dawn, about 4 o'clock in the morning then, and that's when we really bumped into them. And we had a quick fight then, and the whole battalion swung round to the right to encircle them. And then from then onwards, the attack mounted right the way up through, right the way along Kawima Ridge. We dropped one company off to contain where I'd bumped into them, then the whole lot swung round right, and all the companies swung right the way down. And the battle went on for about 4 days then, before we established any position, we hung on to it, and then the Royals come up to help us out. Royal Scots, it was. We always called them the Royals.
So you managed to get right round the back of...
We got round the back of them and got right down. We actually came down the back of them because we took them completely by surprise. Originally, there was supposed to be gunfire. We were supposed to lay down a barrage from our artillery. But we got there before the barrage was due to start. So we had to cancel the barrage quickly because we was already on our positions. And we just carried on. It was once the impetus of the advance had started, we didn't want to stop, let a barrage come down because it would drop down on us. And we didn't want that. So the barrage was cancelled. We just swept on straight away down, all three companies.
So were the Japanese on the ridge then completely cut off?
A lot of them were. Well, they were just killed right off, bunker by bunker. It was just blown up and we just occupied it. But over the back from the surrounding areas, they continued up a terrific barrage of sniper fire the whole time, which we lost a lot of people on that, did a lot of damage. And later the Royal Scots came back around by the back of us and cleared the other ridges out. They'd line up about 10 Bren gunners at a time, and all the trees and everything was sprayed. The Jap used to get right up the top of the tree and shoot down.
You said that you were with carrier platoon.
Yes, but what we called dismounted action. It was like from the old cavalry day, dismounted action. We couldn't get our carriers had come up, but we couldn't use them any further, so all the Bren gun crews and carrier crews, we formed a platoon of our own onto the main body. It couldn't be used as we should have been on the road, you see. We wanted every man to in the encircling movement. So everybody, every headquarter company came, mortars were carried, all the signal groups, everybody, pioneers, the whole lot, which all formed part of headquarter company. They all went.
Did you take part in any, personally, in any attacks on the Japanese bunkers on GPT Ridge?
Yeah, not on the Tyre Ridge, I did on the lower ridge. I went round on the... there was several large bunkers low down, but they could fire up onto the ground, and they were causing a lot of concern. And Captain Randall... VC, by the way, I was about 100 yards behind him when he attacked that machine gun nest. He was subsequently killed, and a corporal with him was killed.
You mean we attacked a posthumous VC for that action?
Yes. And we attacked the next one as well to him, and we captured that one, and we held that position. There was like three bunkers in a line, but the Japs was only not far away in other bunkers that we couldn't get at. But Captain Randall got the posthumous VC there.
Did you see anything of it?
I saw the initial going out, yes. Been going out. I was there when he was briefed to attack that. He'd already been wounded in the leg previously from sniper and mortar fire. So he took a section out then.
How did the Japanese resist on GBT Ridge?
To the last man. There was no surrender. There was no surrender. You could never make a Jap surrender. If he was in a hole, you had to get him out of the hole. You dropped a grenade in or down up to him and shot him. He'd never have no thought of surrender.
Would you and your comrades have been willing to accept Japanese surrenders?
Frankly, no.
Why not?
Well, A, we had to feed them, and we built up a real hate campaign against them, which exists to this day.
Why was that?
Well, our particular regiment lost three battalions, 4th, 5th and 6th, at Singapore. And the stories that had filtered back to us, the Japanese very handy person with a bayonet when you're unarmed. And one or two prisoners had been taken of the Royal West Kents, and they'd been terribly treated, used for bayonet practice. Now, we all knew this, so we weren't prepared in any case. It didn't mean to be brief. Of course, he threw his hands up. It didn't mean anything.
Did that ever happen, where they threw their hands up?
Not that I saw. They never bothered to throw them. I knew they was going to be dead. That was their way of life. They were prepared to die. Even if they just sat there, as I saw later on, further on in the campaign, if they knew they was outnumbered and going to die, they just sat there and very placidly waited for it.
So, did you personally get right to the top of GPT Ridge?
Yes, I was at the top when we first started down. We got right to the top. We came down on the left-hand side when some of our other companies were on the right.
So what would you find in the way of equipment and possessions in the Japanese bunkers?
One bunker I went in, they had all English cigarettes, which they'd taken off of our dead from the Royal West Kents. Watches. It was all small stuff. Flags, money. When I say money, it was Japanese printed Indian money, which was absolutely worthless. I mean, they had thousands of rupees, but it was worthless money. It was just paper. All small items like that. There was nothing of value.
What did you think of the Japanese military equipment?
Nothing to really write home about. I mean, it was nothing that we say, well, it was a beautiful thing or anything. They could use it, I'll say that. They knew how to use it. Their rifles were certainly no better than ours. They had a small mortar, which they could use quite effectively. That was equivalent to our 2-inch mortar. Grenades were the same power as us. They had a small field gun, which they could use very effectively too. They bring it right up close, and they could use that almost over open sights. But when you compared them, the Japanese equipment, later on with what the American and our own equipment bought, began to get derived, they weren't on par at all. There was little or no air force, no air support for them at all. I think over a course of a year, I did see about 12 planes come over, Zeros, or Japanese planes that bombed the crossroads, and that was all from the air point of view, because we had complete and utter domination of the air. On Coima Spur, we were supplied by Dakotas flying over the top, dropping parachutes with our food in, water and all that sort of thing.
Is what you call Coima Spur the same as GPT?
Yes,
Ridge?
Yes, it's the same. It's the same bit of ground with different names. BGP Ridge, you get different spurs off of it. We all had our own pet names for it.
And the trek was the manoeuvre round it?
Well, there were several treks. I mean, one main track up to it and then tracks led down to it. I mean, you know, what the Nagas used to use in pre-war days.
No, you said earlier what you called the trek.
Oh, the trek itself, yes. That was, we took off, I think, from one of the milestones right the way down the road and we did a big scene circling movement. It took us about 4 to 5 days. So we had to go right out and then sweep back right the way in, you see. Secrecy was the dominating factor. We mustn't be seen or heard. So we had to move quietly so that the Japs weren't aware that there was a big force moving in behind them.
Did you?
We had to adopt that attitude the whole time. I mean, we couldn't make too much noise. There couldn't be any shouting or any of that thing. We had to keep quiet. We moved through the jungle by day quietly.
It was the object of the Japanese at Kohima and Imphal to break into India. Did you ever think they could do it?
They were in danger of doing that, had it not been for the 7th Division and the 2 Div. Had not 2 Div got to Kohima, they could have been right the way down the road to Dimapur, onto the plains of Dimapur, and they'd have been literally, India was spread out before them. So, there had to be troops rushed up and there at that particular time. The Japanese had spread themselves out over a wide area and were really going. They were living off the country. They were in danger of getting there.
So you felt it was touch and go, did you?
Yes, we did feel it was touch and go. I mean, the admin box further down down in Burma had was completely and totally cut off, absolutely surrounded.
What happened next after the capture of GPT Ridge?
Well, it was all, it was surrounding more or less daily little battles of people trying to gain various little areas. I mean, if a Jap launched an attack on trying to get a site or group of bunkers, he'd be repelled, and it went on daily like that. It was getting harder for them to hold out because we...